Teaming up to bid on an agency contract is not uncommon, but more organizations can complicate the details of the contract, and that can turn into legal trouble for some of those organizations. Rocky Galloway is senior counsel in the government contracts practice group at General Counsel, and looking at a specific case where a team solution ended up in court. I imagine, Rocky, that's the worst possible outcome for this, but you probably see teaming agreements and teaming relationships everywhere on the spectrum. What are some of the places where this specific case went wrong? Give us the details on that, and we'll talk more broadly about teaming agreements in a moment. Thanks for being on the program today.
No problem. Thank you. Thank you for having me on the program. Yeah, this is all came about, I guess, a couple of years ago, really, and it actually went to the appellate court in Virginia as well. So there were two contractors involved here, CyberLock Consulting and Information Experts, and they were bidding on a contract at the Office of Personnel Management. And in that contract, CyberLock was going to be the subcontractor with 49% share, and Information Expert would be the prime contractor with 51% share. Where this went awry is that the parties could not come to an agreement after the contract was awarded to Information Experts, and they didn't come to an agreement within the time specified in the teaming agreement. And so the CyberLock decided that they would then litigate it because they felt that they should have had a team agreement and had a subcontract agreement actually put in place between the two parties.
It strikes me that I can understand the sentiment there, but if it wasn't defined ahead of time, it's hard to see why you would assume that you had something in place when you didn't actually have something in place.
Well, and that's the thing about teaming agreements, right? And which is why we're having this conversation and why this whole this case generated kind of a lot of buzz and excitement around Virginia, even to the extent that we have some clients saying they don't want to use Virginia law for their teaming agreements anymore. And that's not exactly the right course of action. What was great about this case is that the court provided some really instructive information about how to make these contracts enforceable, right? And so one of the things you want to do, you want to have as much specificity in the contract as possible. The problem with the CyberLock teaming agreement was that they talked about their work share, right? But they didn't talk about exactly what work CyberLock was going to be doing, right? And so without that information, the court said, you know, I see something here, but it's not clearly defined, mm-hmm. right? And ultimately, the court said, you know, this is going to be, we look at this as an agreement to agree, right? You guys are entering into a teaming agreement, agreeing that at some point down the line, you will enter into an agreement for a subcontract, when really what you want to have is this teaming agreement be that definitive document that talks about the role that each party is going to play. And, you know, we advise clients now, to the extent that you can, have a copy of that subcontract agreement that you're going to put in place in that teaming agreement.
Yeah, it strikes me, I'm certainly no attorney, and I don't claim to be anywhere near an expert on any of these issues, but just the experience that I've had in talking to people like you and talking to vendors who have walked down this road before, it seems to me that best practice number one is have everything in writing as explicitly as is practical given the situation.
Yeah, I would agree. I would agree. So at our firm, we represent a lot of small and medium-sized businesses, and they're typically subcontractors to larger businesses. And so we always advise them to protect their interest, to make sure that things are as specific as possible. One of the key important provisions and agreements for our small business clients is this payment terms, right? So if you think about getting into an agreement with a prime and you're a small business and your payroll is very important to you, meeting payroll. And so the terms of payment should be in a subcontract. So to the extent you can get that subcontract included in the teaming agreement and have those payment terms also as part of that, it works out very well. And the way I always pitch it to clients is you're in no better position than right now when you're starting to team to negotiate and bargain, right? Because this is when it's beautiful. The relationship is fresh and it's wonderful and
everybody loves everybody.
Everybody loves everybody. This is going to be a fantastic deal. We're going to go forth and conquer. We're going to win this deal. We're going to all make loads of money. The government's going to be happy. We'll be happy, et cetera. So, and if you are in a position as a subcontractor where you're brought on the team in an exclusive arrangement, then you have even more leverage to negotiate some of those terms. And to have that subcontract at least a draft of it anyway, as part of that teaming agreement, and then negotiate some of those hard-to-negotiate terms up front, like payment, so you don't wind up in a situation where the prime contract has been awarded, right? Everybody's happy now that we got the award, but then we've got to go through this hard negotiations at that point with your prime as to what the specific terms of the subcontract are going to be.
Rocky Galloway of General Counsel is my guest on Industry Chatter. I guess what jumped out at me as I read through your what you wrote up about this, and we have a link to that at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon, Rocky, was if I'm a sub and I'm going to hope one day to become a prime and work with the government, I wouldn't sign a contract with the government that didn't explicitly state, I will do this work, and in exchange for that, you will pay me this amount of money. And so I wonder why companies who are hoping to get to that level someday are willing to enter into an agreement like that with a prime where they don't have that information in place. And I'm not even thinking about it from a security or CYA or any of that kind of thing. Yeah. I'm just thinking about this is kind of the basics of the transaction, and we want everybody to be clear about what the expectations are.
Right. And Francis, I agree with you. But if you go back and you think about a small business who is perhaps trying to break into a market, they've leveraged a relationship to get into a teaming agreement with a suitable prime, they are anxious and they are eager. Mm. So we find clients who will, you know, subjugate some of their needs,
yeah,
you would think, you know, practically speaking, you want to have for the sake of entering this relationship, hoping, betting, praying that when you get to the subcontract, these things will be ironed out.
In this specific case, Rocky, you point out three things, and we've touched on them, but let's make sure that people are clear on the three things that they can learn from this case. The first one is the expected subcontract was discussed merely as a possibility. Again, you've touched on that, but detail the reasons why that's a bad idea.
Yeah. So in teaming agreements, typically you'll see language that says the subcontract will be entered into, will after the contract award, we will begin good faith negotiations to negotiate a subcontract between the parties, and that if we can't, at the end of 30 days or so, after the good faith negotiations, we can't come to agreement, then all bets are off, right? So you don't want that situation to happen at all. You want to have it where typically you say the contract has been awarded, the subcontract will be executed within 5 days after the award, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting in this CyberLock case is that there were not one, but there were two different teaming agreements in place with their prime. And the first one had that specific language in it that says, we will negotiate a subcontract with you within 5 days. There was no language about depending upon government approval, no language about depending upon reasonable efforts to negotiate a contract in 30 days. It was simply, you get the award, we get a subcontract, we get it within 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what happened in that case.
The second one is the subcontractor's role in the performance of the prime contract wasn't defined, and that's another one that you've touched on. But and that one seems to me potentially to be the most problematic of these three things.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, again, it goes back to the eagerness of some subcontractors in getting into the business. As long as you have the share in some people's minds, some clients' minds, you have that 49% share, which in this CyberLock case, if you think about it, 49%, and I don't know all the details of the work that they were doing, but 49% is a pretty hefty share,
mm-hmm,
right? And so if you think, I'm going to get 49% of the work, then you're happy with that. You sign a teaming agreement. You start working together on the proposal. Again, betting that once the award happens, you start negotiating it. A much better, a much stronger position, again, doing it up front. Look at the solicitation requirements. Start to carve out what piece of work is going to be for you and what's going to be for your prime, right? And then to the extent that you can, delineate that very, very clearly in the teaming agreement. So typically you'll see the statement of work in Exhibit A of the teaming agreement. So you can talk about work share, you can talk about the 49%, but in addition to that, talk about specifically what work it is that you're going to be taking on as a subcontractor.
The third point, the third lesson to learn is one we haven't yet gotten to, and that's the teaming agreement stated any subcontract, quote, may be subject to the approval of the client. And you're right, this is very problematic. Why is that?
Yeah. Well, that goes back to this concept that the court held in the cyber law case, the agreement to agree, right? So having any contingencies in there would lend the court to think that the agreement is unenforceable because there's just a lot of contingencies there, and we're not definitizing what the actual result of the agreement is going to be. We are agreeing that we're going to enter into a teaming agreement, and then we're going to agree later, sometime later in time, whenever that might be, as to what the terms of the subcontract agreement and what you really ultimately want to get to, Francis, is that subcontract agreement. So, again, if it was a subcontract agreement, certainly the court would look at that and say that that was an enforceable one. But the way this teaming agreement was structured, it was that agreement to agree. But it wasn't enough definitive terms and conditions in that teaming agreement to allow it to be enforceable.
The overall concept that people should think about when they're considering teaming agreements, especially companies, as you mentioned, that are coming to you and maybe dealing with this for the first time or have only dealt with it a couple of times, is what, Rocky? What's the top line issue they should be taking away?
That you're in no better bargaining position than when you start this relationship. Mm-hmm. I mean, I make the analogy to, like, you know, the couples getting engaged. I mean, this is when it's all wonderful and great. And so this is when you start to talk very clearly at that point, when things are good, about what those terms that you need to have. And again, for our small business clients, we see, you know, we see the payment terms piece. And it's also interesting that there's sometimes a bait and switch that happens, right? And small businesses are very wary of that. So you have a large business client who might bring you on the team because you have certain socioeconomic status, right? You might be an 8A company or a woman-owned company, et cetera, right? And you look great to have that on the team because you help them meet their goals, which is what they're required to meet by the government. And then once the award happens, then all of a sudden, you know, your role in this ultimate work has been diminished somewhat. So, again, all of these things you want to think about up front. You're in the strongest position at that point at the teaming agreement. Make sure you've got as much specificity in that agreement as possible to protect your interests.
You mentioned at the beginning that this case has caused some companies to think they didn't want to do teaming agreements under Virginia law, Rocky. And you made it sound, at least to me, like that might be a bit of an overreaction. Did I read you right on that? And if I did, why is that?
Okay. You read me right on that. I think it is a bit of an overreaction. I think, you know, when you have cases like this and they come before the court, and again, this one went all the way to the appellate level, I mean, it helps everyone to go back and take a look at their current teaming agreements and look in there to make sure that there are terms that are going to be enforceable. This case laid out a very clear path about what it is that you need to have in the agreement to be enforceable. And so I ultimately think it was a good thing. And I don't think it's time to run for the hills, you know, and make Delaware or some other jurisdiction the governing law in your teaming agreement. I think now the court in Virginia, the federal court in Virginia, has said to you, this is what we need to have in the teaming agreements to make them enforceable. So it makes it very clear.